we're going on in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians, we are picking up some very important concepts here. And I hope we're not pushing, you know, just pressing too far philosophically. I don't really mean to do that, but I like to get a base for our thinking, you know. I don't like to just give you platitudes and cliches and stuff. I like to understand where I'm coming from, and a footing. You have to have a footing for what you believe. And we have in the course of our thinking established a very important distinction between the spirit realm and the realm of the flesh, thus gotten a grasp of life, the overall picture, the overall meaning of life, which we can live with. You know, we don't come through with just religious ideas. I think that's very important for you, that you're not just saddled with religious platitudes or ideologies, but we try to open up the meaning of life so you can live it, and so that you can live it on a plane that is normal and workable, rather than always being in the position of reaching for the cherries on the tree and always getting yourself stretched out of joint trying to get something very high and failing much of the time, which is a very discouraging thing for you. So we're trying to help you get a footing in the matters of faith that you can live with and be comfortable with. There's no reason why you shouldn't be comfortable. I don't think the Lord put together a kind of faith that a person would have to be uncomfortable with all their life. It should be a natural, comfortable thing to be identified with Christ. It doesn't mean you wouldn't have stress and affliction and so forth. It just means that it should flow as a part of your life force rather than something that you're always tripping over, stumbling over, and wrestling with, and all that sort of thing. We wrestle with life, but still we're at the deepest roots of our being. We do have a certain peace that we have interacted with the real things of life. Now, verse 6 of chapter 2, Paul says in verse 6, but we speak wisdom among the consummated. In the King James text there, it says we speak wisdom among them that are perfect. But that is a totally false connotation here, you see. In fact, I've tried to point out to you that the Bible does not use terms, especially related to people, of perfect. Perfectionism, as I've often said to you, is a disease. To strive to be accurate or efficient, this is fine. But striving for perfection per se can be an ego trip. The assumption that one is better than one is, you know. Of course, in school and among parents often, we get the drive to be better than we are. You know, whatever it is we are, we can be better. And that's a nice ideological goal, but it doesn't always work out in life because it gets people on a trip where they become so goal-oriented that they miss the sights along the way. You know, you become so concerned about self-improvement and self-advance and self-perfection that in the meanwhile you trample people that are with you on the way. And the problem with perfectionists is they tend to assume that everybody else ought to be as perfect as they are, and that makes a problem too. So perfectionism is not something one keeps to oneself, but it's something one promotes among other people as well, or exports. And the most perfectionists have an exportable commodity there where it's difficult for them to accept anything less in other people than they accept within themselves. It's hard for the perfectionist to be forgiving, hard to be gracious, and so forth. So what then does Paul mean here when he says we speak wisdom among the perfect? Now, you have to understand that the Greek word there does not mean perfect in the sense of flawless, but it means in the sense of consummated. It's the end, the purpose, fulfillment. I think we could render this, we speak wisdom among the fulfilled. In other words, insofar as one is in the course of God, one is identified with the fulfilled, with the consummated. This is the essence of our whole life on the earth, actually, is that we come into touch with and get into the stream of what it is that God has in mind, because nothing else is of any consequence at all. It doesn't make a particle of difference what you do with your life, even in terms of achievement or anything else, if it is not within the stream of what God has in mind. Now, again, we have the very practical analogy of the automobile that we like to use, that the automobile fulfills its purpose when it transports people down the road. It may be very disreputable looking, and it may cough and sputter a lot, but if it makes it down the highway with its cargo, with its people, it's fulfilled its purpose. On the other hand, you could take a very excellent body of a car, put wheels on it, so forth, and it could be polished and brightly and lots of chrome, and everything is flawless in the body, but the engine doesn't work, so it can't fulfill its purpose. Now, I've told you this is an old analogy, but I think it's apropos here, about the person I knew who had an old antique Model T. It was one of those with a door in the center. You may remember those, Mac. And it's like a baby buggy. He had this thing, and he had it beautifully restored, but he had it parked in his backyard, and he used it for a library. He had books in there, and he'd climb in there and read. No matter how well the car was restored, it was not serving its basic function. On the other hand, if you have an automobile that's battered and beat, but it takes you down the road, you're fulfilling your purpose. What I'm trying to get across is quite distinct from the idea of perfection as the perfectionist thinks of it. We are not the perfect. Christians are not perfect. I don't want to disillusion you tonight or bring about any shock waves to let you in on that, but I don't find the Christians very perfect. In fact, sometimes you find the behavior of people that are not Christians superior to the behavior of Christians. One of the reasons that that is true is fairly logical, and that is because Christians get often so spiritually oriented that they don't stop to take much time with the normal processes of life. And they may be concerned about their spiritual values that they get into a sort of an end justifies the means thing in life. As long as their motives are noble, and how they get at it doesn't matter a whole lot. So they say things and do things that are phony often. For example, and let's say in the religious programming on TV, they may do a number of things that we would regard as a little unsavory in the business world, but they think the end justifies the means, that they're raising money after all for the causes of God. So if they do a little trickery, it doesn't really matter. But that's what I mean when I say often behavior of Christians is inferior to that of non-Christians. Christians often, in the intensity of their axe grinding, don't stop to think of the sparks that are flying in the process, you see. Paul says here, we speak wisdom among the perfect. I have to bring that word out for you, because it doesn't mean perfect in our sense, but fulfilled. So you people are not perfect by any means in terms of your basic conduct. We're not a bunch of goody-two-shoes here. But you are consummated. You are fulfilled in the sense that you belong to the stream of God. So that whether you really always behave as you ought to, or always achieve the things you would like to achieve, whether or not that is true, you do belong to God. And again, as I've so often pointed out, the fact that you're here tonight indicates that you're in that stream, else you wouldn't be here. As we don't raffle off automobiles or anything else here, we just come and enjoy the word together. We don't even have a party or anything else with it. You can identify yourselves with those who are in the stream of what God has in mind for the world, And therefore, you are among those that Paul is speaking to, or rather, you are kindred spirits with those that Paul was talking to here in Corinth. He goes on to say, but we do not speak the wisdom of this age, neither of the rulers of this age, who are being brought to naught. The wisdom, again, of this age, remember we're talking about wisdom that has to do with the understanding of the universe and not with discretion per se. That's not what he's talking about here. But wisdom, the sophistry, the wisdom of the Greeks. I go on to say then, the rulers of this age are being brought to naught. Is a very poignant phrase for Paul, because Paul here is in the midst of this grand ancient culture, which was in a lot of ways not much less grand in Rome as in Greece, but it was a grand culture, and there were gods many and lords many and rulers many surrounding the people or among the people of that part of the world. It was a glorious period of human achievement. The rulers were noble, that is, they were glorious types. They're not noble personally, but they were splendid. The court of Rome, for example, was a very splendid thing. And the rulers were men of heroic proportions in battle, at least in the, maybe legendary history. Paul, living in the midst of an age which had carried human achievement to very high levels. And as I've indicated to you, probably higher levels than we have achieved in our present age in terms of great challenges and accomplishments. As I've talked to you about these ancient buildings, these great temples and structures. For example, on the island of Rhodes in Greece, up on a tall peak behind the little village of Lindos was a temple to Athena. Here on this mountain, which some people found difficult even to climb at all, and some rode on donkeys to get up there, on this tall mountain it was this magnificent temple, these great stones that they were raising. I went out with a couple of our boys last Saturday and picked up a very large rock. I have a sort of thing with rocks. The rock is my Moby Dick. I've had a long, lifelong affiliation and affinity for rocks. I don't know why. Maybe my head is like that, but a rock does not go unchallenged. I mean, it's a great thing to get a half-ton rock off the ground and up into a truck. And it's a challenge, and you don't let the rock beat you. You know, you get it. You may get a heart attack or something, but you get the rock. We went last Saturday and picked up a rock. I'm building a waterfall, and we struggle a little bit to get that rock up into the truck. The rock, most people wouldn't even attack it, but like I say, it's my Moby Dick. I have to attack it, you know. But you think of these people putting thousands of these giant granite boulders up and carved and put into place on as pillars. Some of those pillars were sectionalized, you know, they were not just single shafts. And so they mounted these things in perfect trueness and so forth. And what a grand age it was, and what a grand achievement these people have. Well, Paul, living in the midst of this greatness, where the gods and goddesses of the Greek pantheon were immortalized in stone, he said, but what I'm offering to you is not the wisdom of this age. In a sense, the Greeks thought they had the world by the tail in their cultural achievements. The Romans thought they had the world by the tail in their imperial achievements, their empire building, their technology, roads and aqueducts and things like that. And there was a society in which, in a very strong sense, they all felt that they were pretty good. They had everything under control. Well, it was all brought to naught, because today you go up on that mountain and the temple is in ruins. All of that effort, I think of that, some of the waterfalls that I've constructed, which have been pretty extensive sometimes, with great struggle, you know, and great effort, we put these giant boulders together and make waterfalls. And then I think, what if somebody just came and willy-nilly put a stick of dynamite in it and blew it all up? After you've got all the work of putting that thing together, it'd be very disheartening. And you think, here are all these great struggles and efforts to bring those rocks up there and stones and to build these fantastic temples, and now it's all in ruins. Everything is in ruins. It doesn't matter where you go in Greece, the glory of Greece is in ruins. You go and marvel at the ruins, but you don't think what marvelous people they were. I mean, you do think that they had marvelous achievements, but they don't appear now as being worth a whole lot because they're all spread out on the ground. But he says, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. So God has his sophist, his sophia, his wisdom, but his wisdom is true. See, God is true. You can spend a lifetime surveying the wisdom of this world. If you think of all the thousands of books that have been written on philosophy, and as I've said, I've indicated this before, but you can take your doctor's degree, PhD in philosophy, and you can be conversant with all the great philosophers of the world, past, present, contemporary people. And you can be just as smart as a whip about it. You have everything in hand, and you can quote from any one of these philosophers and all that. And what do you have? Just some educated or uneducated guesses about what life's all about. You don't ever have the feeling you're coming to the truth. You can take course after course of philosophy and never feel you're coming to the truth at all. You're just surveying the scene. But when you get to the wisdom of God, the Sophia of God, you've got a handle on the truth, on reality. Reality, exactly. Truth, as I've pointed out in some of the writings, truth is merely the verbalization of reality. It's reality verbalized. Now, who knows what reality is? Except God. Only in God can you come back to that which is absolutely real. Everything else is a chimera. Everything else is a fantasy, or at least a facade. But when you touch God, you're getting to the roots of reality. Now, the only thing that really gives us the confidence to believe that we are indeed touching truth is because, in the first place, we're really not relying on our own wisdom. That may be a big difference. When you take a course in philosophy, you read the philosophers and you're developing your own mind and you're debating with the philosophers back and forth and you're trying to come to grips with ideas and so forth, and you don't really feel satisfied till you have advanced your own ideas. You know, you don't feel satisfied. You don't go around saying, well, I'm a follower of Hobbes or Kant or something like that. That's all right. Some people speak of themselves as Kantian, but a philosopher doesn't like to stop there and go about saying, well, I'm a Kantian categorialist or something. I'm a Cartesian philosopher, because he wants to take from that and build his own philosophy. He doesn't rest till he has his own philosophy of life. But what we're trying to do is get what God has to say. We're not trying to read the Bible and compare it so that we can use it as material to build our own philosophy. We're taking God's view of things. Well, that does not allow for human arrogance. Because the closer you come to the truth, the less arrogance it is possible to have. When you hear someone who is prating about and who seems to be arrogant in presentation, or brazen in their presentation of truth, then you know the person hasn't got there yet. It's like the person who keeps talking about being, puts on airs of being humble, probably isn't. Like the person who says, my modesty prevents me from letting you know how truly great I am, you know. Whenever you talk about it, it's pretty hard to have it. But it's in terms of truth, the closer you get to actual truth, the less willing you are to be an absolutist. So you're really not depending on your own wisdom, your own thinking, but on God. Well, there's a deep sense within us that God knows what's going on, even if we don't. And we're content with that. We explore truth, and we talk about it. But in the end, all of us have the sense that truth ultimately lies with God, and whether we get at it or not, it's still there, see? And that's what we're relying on. Now, you get help from discussing the things of the Bible here together. You get some help from that, comforts a little bit, and helps you along the way. But not any of us, I think, feel here, and least of all myself, that we have got a corner on the truth. See? We have the absolute truth here. Or that we even know what we're talking about a whole lot of times. We don't even know that. If you were trying to take what we've talked about here tonight and translate it to somebody that you run into tomorrow at lunch or something, and you try to share with them, you probably have a difficult time doing it. But as it comes through to your spirit, it finds a home there, I think. It finds lodging. And you receive it and you say, yeah, that sounds like it's all right, see. But you have the sense that truth really lies in the fact that God is with you, and He knows all about this stuff anyway, whether you and I do or not. I think then it's really a very good feeling, because you don't have then that deep burden of feeling that you're never going to get to the bottom of the universe unless you put an awful lot of effort into it. We talk about these things, but we're dependent on God's spirit within us to carry us along, and not on our ability to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But all of this is nourishment for you, and it gives you comfort and feeling that you have a bead on something that is real, even though you don't have the capacity, as most don't. That is, without working on it, I think most people could develop it, but the ability to philosophize, to get into the jargon and the swing of philosophical thinking, it just really takes going through some college and university courses. If you were to sit down right now and talk with a philosopher, someone who's taking philosophy in college or something, you might have difficulty really doing that. Not because you're not as bright as that person is, because you haven't been exposed to the jargon, the tempo, or the move of philosophical thinking. We're not philosophers here tonight, and we rest in the fact that we really don't have to be philosophers. And even if most of what I'm saying to you goes over your head or in one ear and out the other, you may pick up a little wind in the wind tunnel there. We talk, and some of it goes through and some of it doesn't. But in the end, you're not relying on your grasp of it, but you're relying on the Spirit of Christ to work within you the truth. And what we're saying to you is a simple thing, really, that whereas the ancient world doted on its capacity to delve into the universe or universal thinking, whereas they doted on that and it was a source of pride to them, we don't really expect to understand a whole lot about it, but we leave it with God, and we understand that when we have Him in our spirits, we have the truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. When you take Jesus Christ into your spirit, you have the truth. You may not be able to articulate it, but you have it, and therein you rest. It's as simple as that. Now, this mystery He's talking about, I've told you before that the word mystery in Greek only means unknown to the uninitiated. That is, in other words, a mystery is not something that is never going to be known. People talk about the mystery above, ah, sweet mystery of life, at last I found you, etc., etc. All the Nelson Eddy ballads. But this mystery of life people talk about, talking about love, well, I'm not sure anybody will ever know anything about love. That may be indeed a true unknowable. But the mystery Paul is talking about here, the word mystery means only mysterious to the uninitiated, only unknown to the uninitiated, because he even goes on to say, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery which has been hidden, which God foreordained before the ages unto our glory, which no one of the rulers of this age knew, for if they'd known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But even as it is written, eye has not seen, and ear has not heard, and neither has it entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for them that love him. But God has revealed it to us through his Spirit. And we know some of these things. Again, not arrogantly. It isn't that we know everything, but we understand the essence of the universe. And that's because God, in a way, reveals it to us. He doesn't give us all the answers. He only lets a little light in. Well, in a way, I suppose it's like having something in your collection of musicals in your library, or music library, of albums or whatever, and you have them all there. You don't play them all at once, but they're all there. You have possession of a large block of musical knowledge. But maybe that isn't the best analogy. But the idea simply is we're comfortable with the fact that we have Christ. And because we have Christ, we have access to the understanding of the universe. But we don't have to pull it all out at once, just like you don't have to pull out all your albums and put up 15 recorders and play them all at one time. See? They're there. You have a body of that with you. But that's a weak analogy, but it's something. We have Christ in us, and therefore we have access to the knowledge of the universe and the wisdom of the universe. We can't always understand it, even if we have it. We can't always articulate it, but it's there. And so Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. When we have Christ within us, we have the essence of all knowledge and understanding, and we're comfortable with that. Goes on to say, eye has not seen and ear has not heard, neither has entered the heart of man what God has prepared for them that love him. A lot of people think that applies to heaven. And they think heaven is going to be so glorious that our mind hasn't grasped it yet. That's not what it's talking about. It is true that whatever God has prepared ultimately for the eternal habitation of his people is going to be glorious beyond our comprehension. But when you start describing it, you immediately tarnish it. You know, when you start, as I've said so often, when you start talking about mansions and angels and golden streets and all that stuff, you tarnish the glory because you're pulling it into materialistic terms. You're beggaring the whole thing. But what he's talking about here is the essence of the knowledge of this universe. We know these things because God has revealed them to us.